Welcome to the Weekend Messages podcast from Pastor Philip Gonzalez and Outpost Church. Our mission is to help people say yes to Jesus so they can flourish for the glory of God. And we hope today's message helps you do just that. If you would like to learn more or contribute through giving, you can do both online at outpostchurch.org. And remember, the more you say yes to Jesus, the more you are an outpost of the kingdom of God.
God is good. Amen. There we go. That's like a starter for me. It's a sentiment that I believe, and it's also a habit that I've gotten into. And how many have found out that habits are helpful for getting you places you want to go, right? If you want to have a good fitness experience in your life, you need habits to get you there. Habits, of course, can take us in bad directions. We know this. Who's felt that before, right? Bad habits. One of mine is biting my nails. I still haven't kicked it. I haven't really tried. Don't care that much. But you know, it's a habit. But here's what we found out in our series, right? We've been talking about this. We're in a series called Joy to the World, How Jesus Offers Joy in Every Season. And we've been looking at the Christmas story with this question in mind. How do you find joy when? And we've been looking at different ways to look at that. And we've discovered in week one that just like habits are something that kind of move you forward and they become part of you, joy is not just a moment. It's also a state of mind. We found that out in week number one. But the thing about states of mind is, again, like habits, states of mind don't just come, they have to be cultivated. And so we explore that in week one. Also in week one, we ask this question, how do you find joy when you feel you don't measure up? And the truth is, all of us at some point or another, not just we don't feel like we measure up, but sometimes we really don't. Like, there are seasons in life, aren't there, where there are objective standards and we don't meet them, period. No amount of, hey, you're doing okay for you. Well, that's great, but if you have a job and that job has requirements and you can't show up on time, doing good for you doesn't work, right? Today we were at a community Christmas cookie exchange in our community of Babcock Ranch, and I had a great time. Heather baked some amazing cookies, and some other people did too, and we swapped those. But one of the conversations we had was about me and a couple of the guys and I, about millennials, people who were typically born like in the early 80s to the late 90s, somewhere around there. And one of the gentlemen had brought this up because he is an EMS person. He's with the Emergency Medical Service. And he said, you know, we get some of these young guys that come in, and it's great that they want to be paramedics or whatever they do, but they want pats on the back for everything. He said, in fact, they instituted this award. It's called the Phoenix Award. And if you respond to a cardiac arrest call and you help resuscitate the person and they're good and they don't have any permanent neurological damage, you get the Phoenix Award. And the guy was saying, he said, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I remember when you did it just because you saved someone's life and that was enough. You didn't need an award to tell you, hey, good job. You did a good job, right? And he's talking about this, and it's so funny because I thought, well, of course people think that way. If you're raised on participation trophies and raised in environments when no one ever loses, we're all winners in our own way. I love that some people want to encourage people, you know, and help everyone feel good. But the truth is, the real world doesn't work that way. Sometimes you don't measure up. And the way to feel better about that is not to pretend like you do. It's not to pretend like everyone has an equal shot at everything they want to do. If you're working at a job, the answer to feeling better is doing better. But the good news that Jesus offers, watch this, is Jesus is not your employer. And Jesus does offer grace when you don't measure up. And Jesus does say that you are valued and worth it when you don't hit the mark, when you don't do it right, when you don't measure up. And Jesus offers, watch this, Jesus offers much better than a participation trophy that is unearned and undeserved. He offers the grace of a relationship with him that he paid for because he loves you. And that gift is offered not just to the people who do a good job, but it's offered to all the people. And that's what we explored in week one, is that all the people, the shepherds, received the good news of Jesus, and it was good news of great joy for all the people. And it was good news for us too. Last week, we explored this big idea. We said, we're talking about blessings. And we talked about how every blessing comes with a burden, but every burden comes with a blessing. And we explored the story of Mary and how so much of her story, it's easy to gloss over and sanitize because we've heard the Christmas story so many times. But we looked at how from her unplanned pregnancy to her difficult delivery to her very stressful infancy with Jesus to the non-standard childhood and certainly his unorthodox adulthood, we looked at how her whole journey as a mother was very different. And there were lots of blessings, but there were lots of burdens. And we explored how in our life, every burden that comes to us also comes with a blessing, and every blessing comes with a burden. And the way to find joy when no one understands what that burden is like is by choosing. Are you going to focus on the burden, or are you going to focus on the blessing? We explored how we can do that last week. Tonight, I want to explore with you a message about we three kings. Now, perhaps you know the song, right? We three kings of Orient. Right. I remember growing up, and I'm like, what's Orient R? Is it like a railroad or something? Like the you know, Orient R, Orient Railroad? No, it's like a, it's an active verb, I think. No, it's a being verb, right? R is a being verb. My educated people here, right? Yeah, it's a being verb. It's not joined together. But it's that song of We Three Kings, right? And so I remember being a kid and singing that song, and my favorite part was the chorus, right? Because, oh, and I remember my younger brothers who, my middle brother, John Michael, who will be at my parents' house, hopefully, if they can get through the traffic from Gainesville. He couldn't always pronounce all his words, so he'd say, Star of Wonder, Star of Night. I mean, I never did that, but he did that. And I just remember these fun things. But I remember thinking about these kings, right? And we hear about these kings, and they come, and so that's what we want to explore together. A message I'm calling Wise Men Seek. Turn to your neighbor and say, Wise Men Seek. Wise Men Seek. If you have a Bible, you can turn with me to the book of Matthew, if you'd like. It's the first book in our New Testament, written down by a man named, anybody want to guess? Very good, Matthew. Matthew was a tax collector who, interestingly enough, at the time of Jesus' birth, Matthew was probably a pretty busy guy. If he was, now we don't know how old Matthew was. I would assume he was older than Jesus because Jesus, at the time of his earthly ministry, was around 30 years old. And Matthew is called a chief tax collector. How many of you have figured out, in whatever profession you choose, you normally don't start out in the top position, right? You start typically at the bottom and you work your way up to the top, yeah, or the middle, depending on your level of ability, right? Well, Matthew was called a chief tax collector, so it's likely he was either really good at being really bad, because, of course, tax collectors were people who'd paid Rome for the privilege of extorting their fellow Jewish people. He was either really good at being really bad, or he'd just been in it a while. We don't know for sure. If he was alive and active at this time of Jesus' birth, we know he was busy, because this is the time when the whole world, according to Luke's gospel, the whole world was supposed to be taxed. Now, most of the time, when you see the whole world in Scripture, you need to look at the context to figure out what it means, because sometimes it means the whole span of humanity. Sometimes it means all of the created order, including, you know, rocks and plants and trees and animals. Sometimes it means, as in this particular case in the Gospel of Luke, the whole world refers to the whole Roman world. And Caesar Augustus decided he wanted to make sure that nobody was slipping under the radar and not paying their taxes. And so he had this census that was taken, and so he was very motivated to get all the people registered. That, of course, is how Joseph and Mary ended up in Bethlehem, and that, of course, is the type of thing that Matthew would have been very involved in since he was a chief tax collector. Now, we don't know if he was alive at the time of Jesus' birth, but he certainly was alive at the time of Jesus' ministry, and that's how he met Jesus. And Jesus changed his life so much that Matthew went from recording people's names and financial records for tax purposes to wanting to record the life and ministry of Jesus the Messiah. And his gospel, interestingly enough, Matthew's gospel, his account of Jesus' life, is written from a perspective that is very Jewish-oriented. Because Matthew was motivated to help his fellow Jewish people really get that this Jesus was their promised Messiah, foretold in Scripture. It's interesting because Luke's gospel, from which we get a larger portion of the Christmas story, that was written mostly to Gentiles, people who were non-Jewish. And so Luke doesn't include a whole lot about prophecy and things like that, but Matthew does. And I found it so fascinating that Matthew was so concerned about helping his fellow Jewish people see Jesus. Because up until Matthew met Jesus, he had very little concern for his fellow Jewish people at all. In fact, he'd paid for the privilege of extorting them for his own personal benefit. How amazing that Jesus changed Matthew's life so much that he would devote all the education he would have had to get to be a chief tax collector. And he would have devoted all those connections he made with other people to pull together this account of the life of Jesus the Messiah. And so it's from his account and from this perspective of someone who wanted to speak to Jewish people that Matthew writes this account of wise men visiting the king. And so here it is in Matthew chapter 2. We'll read verses 1 through 12. And explore. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of King Herod, everybody say Herod. You should know that Herod was so bad as a ruler. And I don't mean he was incompetent. I mean he was a wicked dude. He was so bad that there was a famous pun I don't remember the actual Greek, or I think it was Latin actually. But Caesar, who was reigning at this time, he had this comment that was recorded by one of the historians that he would rather be Herod's dog than Herod's son. In Latin, those two are really similar. It's like a play on words. But the reason is because Herod had several of his offspring assassinated so that they wouldn't rise up to take his position of power. Herod also had one, maybe even two, of his wives murdered because he was concerned and he had suspicion that they were plotting against him. So Herod the king is one paranoid dude, and he has no problem shedding blood to make sure that he stays in power, a fact which, of course, plays into the story here. So after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, wise men from the east arrived in Jerusalem. Everybody say wise men. Wise men. We'll come back to that. That's not what it actually says. That's the interpretation of it, but we'll come back in a minute. Wise men arrived in Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him." Now, pause here for just a moment. Two things we're going to see. When the first readers of Matthew's gospel would have heard this, they would have likely had their ears perked up, because remember that at the time this was written, probably about 50, 60 AD, give or take a couple decades, at the time this was written, Rome was still in power and the Jewish people were still an oppressed nation. So for them to hear the King of the Jews, well, that's interesting, because Herod had been called King of the Jews, but nobody liked him. In fact, Herod was an Idumean. He came from the line of Esau. You may remember, maybe not, Jacob and Esau, two brothers. Jacob was chosen by God to be the forefather of the Jewish nation. Esau was rejected, and it was from Esau's line that Herod was descended. So Herod was called the King of the Jews, but no Jewish people wanted him to be. So here's this note that there is a King of the Jews that's about to enter the story. Their ears probably would have perked up. Herod's ears perked up too. The story continues in verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was deeply, what's the Bible say? disturbed or troubled. Anybody have a different word? Think really anxious and upset. Have you ever been really distressed, really anxious and upset about some news that you heard? Take that and amplify it. And it says, he was deeply disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, this probably doesn't mean the entire city. This probably means the people who were the leaders of Jerusalem that Herod had gathered around him. And we know this because it continues. So he assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people and asked them where the Christ would be born. In Bethlehem of Judea, they told him, because this is what was written by the prophet. Notice that Matthew is including this portion of the story because he knows Jewish people really cared about what their prophets had said. And they were really motivated to know if those prophecies were going to come true. In Bethlehem of Judea, they told him, because this is what was written by the prophet, verse 6, and you, Bethlehem, this is from Micah 5, verse 2, by the way, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, because out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. And when Herod secretly summoned the wise men and asked them the exact time the star appeared, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. When you find him, report back to me so that I too can go and worship him. I don't know if you use your imagination when you read the Bible, but sometimes I do. I hear him saying, but that's just me. Verse 9, after hearing the king, they went on their way, and there it was, the star they had seen at its rising. I just want to say, oh, star of wonder, star. Okay. It led them until it came and stopped above the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with, what's that word? Joy. One more time. What's that word? Joy. One more time. What's that word? Joy. That's what we're talking about. It's great that they were wise men. It's great that they're going to go and give their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But what we're talking about here is joy. And specifically, watch this. How do you find joy when you're feeling far from God? Because these aren't Jewish people who are actively participating in the temple worship and are waiting for Messiah to come to save them from their sins. These are people who are, they're called wise men here, but the actual Greek text is the word magus or magus, depending on how you pronounce it. The plural is magi or magi. How many have heard magi before, right? Years ago, there was a short story written by a man named O. Henry called The Gift of the Magi. But I used that in a sermon like 6 years ago, so we're not going to redo it. Now, the word magi or magus, from this word, anybody want to guess what English word we get from it? Magic and magician. In fact, this particular word is also used in Acts chapter 13 for a man who is called Simon Bar-Jesus. And then another variant of his name is Elymas. Some people had multiple names back then. But he is called a sorcerer. So this word, which we translate wise men, and there's some reasons for that. We'll get into that in a minute. But the likely origin of this is either Babylonian or Persian. In fact, we see, we're going to get into a little bit of this in a minute, but we see that these men were probably astrologers, not astronomers who were just tracking the planets, because it's interesting, but people who believe that there are clues to their destiny and there are ways to foretell the future and there is an exertion of spiritual power in the divining of things and in magical spells and in trying to discover what the movements of the heavens are telling us. And so it's not strange at all that these magi would be fascinated by some sort of a sign in the sky. What is fascinating to me is that they would have dropped everything and would have traveled likely a great distance to pursue what the sign was telling them. But the thing that you need to know is that these were not good, God-fearing men. These were pagans who had devoted their life to the pursuit of magic. And maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but we're not talking about sleight of hand or interesting magic tricks, right? We're talking about the kind of magic that seeks supernatural power to be brought under your own control. We're seeking a kind of life that seeks to influence the world around you to exert your own personal power. This is the exact opposite of what the God of the Bible, the God of the Hebrew people, instructed. The God of the Bible said to have nothing to do with sorcery or witchcraft, to have nothing to do with trying to divine the future by astrological means. The God of the Bible said, be humble and trust me. And here's the essence of magic, by the way. The essence of magic and its pursuit is this. The essence of magic is my will be done. So I really want you to get that these are not just pretty neat, you know, learned men who happen to be philosophers. They probably were philosophers. It's likely that they had some connection to royalty. But the bottom line is that they were people who had given themselves over to things that the Bible specifically prohibits. And yet, here they are, at great cost to themselves, coming to seek this King of the Jews. If anyone was far from God, probably it was them. Not only because they were far in distance, but they weren't necessarily looking for a God to submit to and worship. They were people that had tried to create their own power. And yet, when they saw the star, verse 10, they were overwhelmed with, what's that word? Joy. Entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and falling to their knees, they worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. It's likely, by the way, we know that some of these gifts have a very special significance. We know myrrh was used as an embalming spice for burial. It's likely that they didn't necessarily intend it that way. What's most likely is that these were simply costly and precious gifts that they brought as an act of really, well, the fact that they bowed down and worshipped him, that's kind of significant, right? Don't miss this, right? People who had devoted their lives to pursuing their own personal power, when they encountered Jesus, fell down and worshipped him because they recognized a power even within him that was far greater than anything they could ever know. When you have a life-changing encounter with Jesus, it really does change your life. And so that's their story. They are called wise men. The use of the word wise men, nothing wrong with that. It's probably a little closer to Matthew's intent than magicians. Matthew's intention wasn't to show that people who were sorcerers were coming to worship Jesus. He was pointing out that people who had been, watch this, people who had been studying the ancient texts had seen in them that this was the Messiah. Remember that Matthew has a purpose. We talked about this earlier. Matthew is writing to his fellow Jews, and he wants to demonstrate to his fellow Jews that Jesus is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And we find this all throughout his gospel, where there are more references to the Old Testament in Matthew's gospel than in any of the other gospels, maybe even in any other book in the New Testament. And Matthew is doing that because his singular focus point is helping the Jewish people see this is their promised Messiah. So in that context, his use of this story to illustrate that, he's not really focusing on the sorcery part. He's focusing on their understanding of prophecy part because he's making a point. I want to focus on the sorcery part so you get that people who are far from God are not without hope and are not without opportunity. And like we said, they were far from God. They came from the east. Now, when we see this phrase, from the east, it just means from that direction. But we can kind of extrapolate a few things. It's likely that the place from which they came was either Persia or Babylonia. Of course, over time, these two got melded. And I wanted to show you this map. You can see on the left, Jerusalem, there on the Mediterranean Sea. If you notice the scale, 400 miles to the east, certainly by way of Ribla, and then down, that is the surmised route of where the Jewish people were taken in the year 586 BC, when the nation of Israel was conquered by the armies of Babylon. And the people were enslaved, were put in chains, and were carried off. You can read the Old Testament record and see this listed there. Heartbreaking stuff. But they were carried away to Babylon, and one of the reasons that I think we can make a safe guess that these wise men from the east, these magi, were probably from that region, is by simply asking this question. How did they know to look for a king of the Jews in the first place? Well, if there was a whole nation of Jewish people carried off into Babylon, which there were, and if those people in Babylon continued to practice their religion, which they did, and if those people in Babylon were told to treat their neighbors well and to represent well what it meant to be a follower of Yahweh, which they were. In fact, we find this in Jeremiah. God tells his people to build houses, to plant vineyards, to marry, to build a life there. Well, it would make sense that those people who were deported from their homeland would have also shared with even their oppressors the truth about the Messiah that they were seeking. And I find it interesting that these men who had come from this far away, they had found something in the scriptures that had been shared with them. We don't know how they were shared with them. We don't know what they knew. We don't know exactly how it came to pass. But we know that something had happened. Watch this. Something had happened in their heart. Because I don't know about you, but I can read any number of interesting things, and I'm not motivated to travel 400 miles west to a place that I have no idea where I'm going just to seek out some answer to prophecy. Right? That's kind of a big ask, right? That's a lot. But something had happened in their heart that had motivated them to leave their home and to travel to a place they didn't know where they were going because they believed that there was something promised them and they believed the promise was good. And that sounds a lot like, well, sounds a lot like Abraham, who also received a promise, but something happened in his heart to make him listen to that promise. For him to travel to a place that he didn't know, seeking a destination that he wasn't promised, where it would be, because he believed that there was something waiting for him that was good. And so these men travel. And we find in the scripture then three particular things. Because if anyone was far from God, it was probably these magi. And yet, somehow they were brought close. What was it that brought them close? Well, first, I'd like to argue that it was God who awakened their hearts in the first place. But there were three specific things that they actually did. And maybe you've been in a season of your life when you feel far from God. Maybe you've been in a season in your life when you were living in a way that really was far from God and God rescued you. And I think many of us have that story. Some of us don't. Some of us, like me, I grew up in church. I didn't have some season where I was off selling drugs and running a prostitute ring or doing, like, I didn't have that running away from God season, but I know there's been plenty of seasons when my heart felt distant. And what do you do, and how do you find joy when that's you? I think we can find a clue in what they did then. Take a look with me. A couple of the verses in this account, Matthew 2:2. They arrive, right? So the wise men come from the east, and they arrive. And here's what they say. They say, where, everybody say where? Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? So here's the first thing that I found interesting. So they'd gone on their journey, that was great, but now they're here in the capital city, and I found it interesting that the wise are willing to ask. They don't just kind of show up and start poking around thinking they have all the answers. There's great wisdom in being willing to admit that you don't know and be willing to ask someone you believe does. Now, in this particular case, Herod didn't really know, but the people that he was surrounded with did. And so the fact that the wise were willing to ask shows that they were humble and didn't have to have it all together. When you're feeling far from God, maybe the first thing to ask, first thing to do really is just ask, why am I feeling this way? And not just ask yourself, maybe it's worth taking the time to ask someone else to let them in, to admit that you don't have it all together and acknowledge that that's okay. Because sometimes the greatest thing you can do when you're feeling far from God is let someone else know about it and be willing to ask. So they ask, and they get this note, this direction. They didn't have a GPS, but they had a star, which is cool. And so they get pointed in the right direction, and apparently the star moves, which is really neat. But they go on, and we find here, next slide, we find in chapter 2, verse 8, so Herod sent them to Bethlehem, and he said, go and, what's that word? Search carefully for the child. So the wise men, they ask, and then they get their general direction, but that doesn't send them to an exact house number, does it? No. What do they have to do? They have to search. And listen, here's the truth about people who are wise. Watch this. The wise are willing to seek, to not just sit back and expect the answers to come to them. People who are wise know that sometimes you have to get off your stool and actually go and dig into something. Look into it. Leave no stone unturned. I love this about the wise men. They didn't just sit in the palace and sip mimosas with Herod and have underlings go and find the house number and report back. They were willing to get up, get out, and go look. When you're feeling far from God, you got to be willing, if you're wise, to ask. Ask God to speak to you and ask others to maybe speak into your life, but then be willing to seek. You might find out, watch this, you might ask, why am I feeling far from God? And you might get an answer for that. Well, then the question is to seek, okay, well how can I change that? Well, how can I find a solution for that? Well, what can I do about it? See, the wise men were willing to get up and they went to seek. And so they did, right? They go and they find the house. And then in verse 10, when they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with joy. Because the star led them until it came and stopped above the place where the child was. We have no idea what that's about, but needless to say, it was rather supernatural, which is pretty cool. But then in verse 11, we see this. Entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. Now, what's that word say? Entering. Very good. And I was thinking about that. Here's what the text doesn't say, but I think the fact that they were wise men, probably you could infer this. I certainly hope they didn't just kick the door down and stomp in, right? Ta-da! Behold, we, the Magi, have come with gold. Right? But I think I'm gonna take a little leap of faith. Can I take a leap of faith with you? Can we do that? All right. Here's what I'm gonna say: the wise are willing to knock. Because I'll tell you what, right now, when my son Bradley wants to come into mommy and daddy's room, he better knock if he's wise. Because we've told him time and time again, always knock before you come, right? Sometimes you have to be willing to not just ask the question, why am I feeling far from God? To not just seek the reason for it, but then maybe you'll find the reason for it, but you got to knock. You got to knock on that door and see if God will open it. Because most of the time, watch this, most of the time when we're feeling far from God, it has a lot to do with things we did, but it also has a lot to do with whether we're willing to take the steps God calls us to take to solve whatever issue it is that brought us out of fellowship with Him. I've never been a sailor. I've never been one to go spend a lot of time on the ocean. Anybody like boats? Go out on the water. Okay, one person. My wife, love you, baby. Gwen too, right? But I understand this to be true about navigating on large bodies of water. You can get off course one tiny degree at a time, and before you know it, you can be so far from where you started that it's not enough. Listen, it's not enough to make one degree difference and try to get back. Sometimes you have to turn that rudder, and you have to be willing to make some major changes. Asking is good, gets you in the region. Seeking is good. It gets you to find the problem. Knocking is important because it's knocking on the door that eventually opens the solution. And as I was looking at this, maybe you're noticing the pattern here. Maybe for you, you're noticing, well, this isn't the only place in the Bible that has something to say about asking and seeking and knocking. In fact, Jesus talked about that, and Matthew wrote it down. You can turn there if you want, but we'll have it on the screen. Matthew wrote down this moment in Jesus' ministry that's part of a teaching called the Sermon on the Mount. And we had a whole series on the Sermon on the Mount called something really clever and interesting, and I forgot what it was called. But the Jesus Revolution, I think it was called. Yeah, it was the Sermon on the Mount. I remember the icon. I remember the graphic we did. It was really cool. So Jesus is saying this in the Sermon on the Mount. Here's what Jesus says about asking and seeking and knocking. This is Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 11. It starts this way. Jesus says, everybody say it with me. Ask, and it will be given to you. Then he says, say it with me. Seek, and you will find. Then he says, knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks. To the one who knocks, the door will be opened. So watch this. Jesus is saying something about the way we live our life in relationship with God. And we know that this is not just, I'm sorry, go back, please. We know that this is not just a generic statement about how you live your life because of what comes after it. Because here's what comes after it, right? Verse 9, Jesus continues his thought. He goes on, next slide. He says, who among you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your, what's that say? Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him. So when Jesus is talking about asking and seeking and knocking, he's not just making a blanket statement about everything. You could probably apply it to that. But what Jesus is specifically talking about is the way that we have a relationship with God and what we do in that relationship with God. And maybe you know this, maybe you haven't heard this before, but the Greek text, or the tense rather, the verb tense of ask and seek and knock, it's the idea of an ongoing activity, right? It's the idea of ask and keep asking and keep asking. It's the idea of seek and keep seeking and keep seeking. I wonder if the magi, the wise men, they didn't just like ask once and wait for everything to happen for them, did they? Doubtful. I mean, if you've ever spent any time reading Old Testament prophecy, you probably know sometimes it's a little obtuse, a little thick. It's a little hard to understand. But they kept at it. And when they realized that there was this astronomical, or they would call it an astrological phenomenon, they made the connection. They had kept asking, and they found a direction to head. And then they started seeking, and they didn't stop, right? If we could surmise that they came from the region of Babylon, that's a 400-mile trip. They kept seeking, kept seeking, kept seeking. And then knocking, right? I have no idea how many times they knocked. If it was, you know, Mary, Mary, Mary. I don't know, right? Or if it was just a one-time thing, I have no idea. But we know that they knocked until they got in. You need to know that if you're looking for how to find joy when you're feeling far from God, you don't just ask once, you keep asking. You don't just seek for a bit, you keep seeking till you find it. You don't just knock once and then give up because I guess he's not home. You know why? Because Jesus said that when we compare our human desire to do good things for our kids to God's desire to do good things for his people, we're all evil in comparison to his goodness. That our goodness is like evil compared to the incredible goodness of God. And this gives us hope. Because listen, if God reached out to awaken the hearts of the Magi, people who were pagan astrologers pursuing sorcery and magic and their own personal power, if God did something, listen, if God was even allowing his people to be deported to a foreign land And if God even used that tragic circumstance so that hundreds of years later, people who weren't interested in the God of the Bible would be drawn in by the Scriptures and by the Spirit, if God would do that for them and enable them to ask and seek and knock so they could find Him, how much more does He want to enable you to be close to Him again when you feel far away? See, here's the good news that Christmas reminds us of. When you're feeling far from God, He still wants to be your Father. When you're feeling far from God for whatever reason, maybe it's because of something you did and you wonder if God could still really love you. Maybe it's because of something that was done to you and something you experienced and you wonder, how could a God of love really let this happen to someone like me? Maybe it's nothing so drastic. It's just been a slow drift over time. And now you go through the motions and you do your Christian thing, but it doesn't feel like it used to. The good news of Christmas is that when you're feeling far from God, He still wants to be your Father, which means that you can ask Him to speak to you, and He will, if you're willing to stick with it until He does. And He will show you the answers that you're looking for if you're willing to seek. And He will open the door that you're looking for, that door of closeness and intimacy with Him, that door of joy, if you're willing to keep knocking. And so my question for me and for you is simply this, threefold. Number one, what questions do you need to ask? Maybe you need to ask, God, when was it that I never stopped believing that You loved me, but when was it that I stopped believing and feeling, rather, that You loved me? Maybe for you, it's something you need to seek. What things do you need to seek? God, what influences are there in my life that are pulling me away from that close fellowship with You? What things, maybe you need to seek, what are those things in my life that are draining my joy and that I need to cut out in this Christmas season and in this new year to come? Maybe for you, you need to ask this question, on what doors do you need to knock? Knocking is about finding the solution, finding the steps to take to actually do something to be set free, because it's well and good to know the problem, it's well and good to know where it came from, but you need to be willing to knock until the door is opened. And I don't know all the particulars of your story, but God does. And you need to know that when you're feeling far from God, you can ask, and you can seek, and you can knock with confidence, because He wants to be your Father. And if He led the wise men by a star, then He'll lead you by His Spirit when you step into that place of faith. And you can find your joy again in every season.
Hi friends, Pastor Philip here, and thanks for joining us today. If you've been blessed, we'd love to know. Please leave a review on iTunes or Facebook, or email us at connect@outpostchurch.org. Also, if you'd like to contribute to this ministry, you can send a text message with any amount to 84321 or just visit outpostchurch.org/give. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next time.